This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine with Macca and Fiona. And our next guest, he's probably going to have a shortbread first, is Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. It's been a big week, Misha, hasn't it? And I suppose there's so much happening, and we're going to, hopefully Josh Burns will be joining us soon. And I know that both he and you would like to talk about The Voice, but we're talking earlier about the number of news sources we look at and trying to get a handle on what is happening in the Middle East. And I said that ABC and SBS have actually quite different reporting of what's happening, or it seems to me that they're reporting from a slightly different perspective. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay,
I'm going to have a short break.
Good morning. I actually want to go in an entirely different direction.
Okay, cool.
Because driving down here, I was listening to you, and one of the things that you were talking about was this idea of news avoidance and a lack of sort of good news and balancing news. So I bring you, driving down here from sunny Brunswick East, where I live, there's actually been some good news that I wanted to share with you, which was that Time Out this year, this week, released its list of the coolest, hippest, best suburbs to live in the world. Brunswick East was number 6.
Oh.
So I was driving down because I do my trip to Joy FM down to St Kilda.
Joy 94.9 FM.
And I do my trip to St Kilda and I think I'm coming down to the cool part of town. It's sort of, it's, you know, quite a long way, but I always look forward to it. It's lovely sort of to drive and be in Fitzroy Street and sort of see it all. But now I'm thinking maybe Brunswick East isn't so bad. So there you go. So there's some good news.
What was number 5?
Number 5, I don't know. I only looked at number 6.
Well, I mean, they did recently, or a couple of years ago, name Smith Street the coolest street in the universe or in the world, which is where I live. And it can be cool, but it also, you know, like all parts of Melbourne, you do wonder sometimes where they cook up these ideas.
Yeah.
Well, as much as I love the people at Time Out, they do a fantastic job.
Yeah, and actually there's a serious issue underneath this, which is a lot of these sort of livability rankings were created, like I think The Economist does one and a lot of different organisations do them. But they've sort of been pitched at the idea really of sort of expat executives who are moving all around the world. So it's based on an assessment of what a city is like for somebody who is quite affluent, has got resources, and it doesn't necessarily tell you a lot about what that city's like for people with other, you know, from other aspects of the community. So that's important to bear in mind.
Misha, can I just, Paul here, good morning. Can I just say that it was 6th coolest neighbourhood in the world, not Melbourne?
Yeah, 6th coolest neighbourhood in the world, yeah.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
I mean, I think that livability also does usually talk about access to things like public transport and, you know,
it
for,
does,
for
yeah.
the access, the fantastic access that you have in inner city Melbourne, there's all those people that live in the outer suburbs that have no access, those new suburbs where they've promised train lines and they're not there. And then, you know, out in Melton, for example, they're considered to be you have to pay all this extra money to go and live in Melton, which is where people, you know, there's a very low socioeconomic group that live out there, and how can they, you know, they can't afford to catch the trains into the city because they're on a V-line train.
That's true. So it's not all about, you know, cafes and fancy restaurants and whatever else it is that I think these things prioritise. And you're absolutely right. Governments need to think a lot about sort of the infrastructure and building that infrastructure. It's a real problem.
Someone said you should wear that on a T-shirt as you come into Joy, Misha. look, I've got it here. I'm going to do the top 10. And my apologies if my pronunciation is not correct. Laurels in Medellin, which is in Colombia. Smithfield in Dublin. Oh, Carabanchel in Madrid, Hovnan in Copenhagen, Shungwan in Hong Kong, Brunswick East, Mid-City New Orleans, Isola in Milan, West Amsterdam, and Tomagaya in Tokyo. There you go. Pasco Vale's not in there.
Pasco Vale, no.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. There you go.
Anyway, sorry. So you did ask a serious question, which we should get back to, which is the coverage of the Middle East. Look, it is so incredibly difficult. Anybody who's worked in any newsroom will tell you that you get more complaints about this topic than any other topic. There was, interestingly, a book written by John Lyons, who is a Middle East reporter currently for the ABC. He's worked at The Australian. He used to edit the Sydney Morning Herald. Very senior, well-respected journalist. And he wrote a small booklet a couple of years ago, maybe about a year ago, about the Australian media's reporting of Israel-Palestine and was critical to some extent of the power of the people who lobby sort of on the Israeli side. But there was also criticism of that book. People said that that book sort of resurrected an anti-Semitic trope, which is that there's sort of a powerful Jewish lobby which influenced things. And in actual fact, you know, the counter-argument you can make is that the representatives of the Jewish community in Australia have got every right to represent their interests and represent them assertively with the media, which they do. I've certainly been the subject of some of that lobbying. I think we've all experienced
it. Is that right? Yes.
Yeah. And look, you know, it takes the form really of if you publish something saying, you know, this is incorrect or it's misleading or it's not the full picture, and then arguing for a different slant on the coverage. And I think, you know, my view is that in a community where you're going to have sort of robust discussion and debate and you've got all sorts of different people, you should have those discussions. And I think, you know, I think it is reasonable for those groups to lobby. I think the difficulty, I mean, for me personally, I have a number of friends who are Jewish people who I know are doing it very tough. And there is all the politics about the balance and what you say about the actions of Israel and the actions of Hamas and all the different parties and moral responsibility. But I think you have to put all that stuff to one side and just say to your friends, look, I know you're doing it tough. This is traumatic. It's horrible. And just deal with the horribleness and respect some of the pain that the different community groups are feeling. And the same goes for the, you know, Palestinian community groups. And then just try to deal with the reporting in the most sober way you can. I would be very loath, Macca, I know the question you asked me was sort of leading towards a comparison of SBS and ABC, and I haven't watched both those coverages thoroughly enough to really to offer a strong judgment. I just say it's so easy to criticise because it's impossible to cover in a way that's that anyone's going to be happy with. So
I saw one story, and I'm not sure if it was, I think it might have been on Al Jazeera. One of their journalists based in Gaza, and he's, you know, he's done lots of reports, and this was a really heart-wrenching story that his wife and his daughter and his grandmother and then were killed in a you know, an area that was bombed by Israel, and his son, who survived the blast but then died very shortly afterwards. And I thought, how do you report this? And it was such a tragic story. But where I'm going with this is, I might have the number wrong. I think there's a couple of dozen journalists that in Gaza that have died, that have, you know, as a result of the bombings. And it's important to remember that, you know, these journalists, they're doing a job, and of course every journalist has a view and has an opinion, and that informs how they report something. To say that that's not the case, it's a matter of degree, but, you know, they're doing a job. Their job is, you know, is not to ask two people whether it's raining outside, it's to actually go outside and see if it's raining. And, you know, we need to respect the work that they do and get a number of views so we can actually get a feeling. And that's why I watch all these different news and reporting a same incident. You really get, there is quite a variation in it, Misha.
Yeah, and look, there is also, I think, a legitimate criticism about any form of media can fall into patterns or thinking within a certain frame, and you have to work outside that frame. So there's a very good Australian journalist I've got a lot of time for called Anthony Lowenstein, who wrote a book a number of years ago called My Israel Question. And he's a he's a more progressive Jewish person who is critical of some of the actions of Israel and some of the treatment of the Palestinians. And he argues that the range, the Overton window, the range of acceptable views or perspectives that you get on this are skewed in a certain way, and that some of the more critical voices don't get represented the way that they should. And I think, you know, he has a point. I think that that's true at times. But I also think that the what happens with this particular issue is this attempt at moral relativism. So, you know, somebody who is, a Jewish person might say, look, you know, this is happening and I'm feeling very upset and angry about it. And somebody will say, what about the Palestinians? And, you know, I just think what we owe all of the people involved in this is sort of our human sympathy and sensitivity as best we can. And then in terms of the reporting, our best efforts at rigour in the knowledge that it's not possible to write a version of this history. For example, we've published pieces by academics, Middle Eastern experts, writing, you know, trying to write short histories to explain people, just the general background. You always get complaints because there are always things, if you write an 800-word history, there are things you have to leave out. And people will always want to tell a story differently from their perspective. So it's complicated. The reporting can't be perfect. And it can't be above criticism. It just can't.
And this is why I think, you know, Michelle and I know that, you know, the conversation has had a whole slew of pieces and on this. And it's important to people to make the time to read them and to look at other, you know, sources of news as well, because you will get a perspective. And it's up to you, the reader or the listener, to decide what you think is correct. But always remember, nothing is ever 100% correct, and nothing is ever totally without a perspective. And you can only report truthfully as a journalist. That's your job, is to report truthfully and from what you observe and what you find out. But we've all got to actually make a decision, don't we, Fiona? About
Yes, we do.
You know, there are a lot of news sources I wouldn't even bother going to.
The only thing I'd say, I think you're absolutely right on selecting your news sources. The thing I think that's really important for me anyway in this is not rushing to form opinions.
Yes.
There's a real pressure currently in sort of the social media age that almost you are your opinions and you have to have an opinion on everything.
Even before you finished reading the post.
Absolutely. And you know, the way that you will get recognition or acknowledgement by others is actually expressing a strong opinion. I stand with so-and-so, or I think this, or I think that.
Yeah.
Now, I actually think it's perfectly reasonable and smart and in many ways good sometimes to stand outside that. I mean, journalistically, certainly, I try to do that, particularly on really contentious issues. And it gives you a chance to look at it more in a way of trying to discover and learn rather than sort of thinking about, I think this and therefore this must happen.
If you're wondering what that noise is, it's Baz.
Who wants a piece of shortbread?
Who has actually discovered how good my shortbreads are.
Because I came in and went straight for it because I heard about it a lot.
So, Baz, you'll get another piece in a minute. You are on Sunday Magazine with Macca and Fiona. Our special guest is Misha Ketchell from The Conversation. Stay with us.
You're on Saturday Magazine with Macca and Fiona and our special guest, Misha Ketchell from The Conversation. So we're moving on now because there's a lot to talk about.
There is.
So we were discussing off air Richard Pratt.
Yes. You know what I find really fascinating? These recordings.
Hold on. It's not Richard Pratt, though. Richard Pratt is the dad. I'm just trying to think.
Oh, no, no.
It's Anthony Pratt?
Anthony Pratt.
Yes. Sorry, that's my mistake. I confused. Richard Pratt's not
Yes, if we're
witness.
Hearing yes. from Richard Pratt, well, you know, we don't have a Ouija board in the studio. Really interesting. The thing that really fascinates me about this is the recordings. Like,
I mean, who records conversations like that? I mean,
and you know how you do it, Misha, if you have a shirt with a pocket. And you just press record on your phone, just put your phone there so it's facing the other way so people don't see it's recording. Or you're doing it secretly. I like Donald Trump's, what was his comment? Oh, you know, that redheaded weirdo from Australia. Well, Well, I mean, you know, he's the man with the orange skin, Donald.
I know. It's
the kidnapped chimp.
The pot calling the kettle black.
So what do you make of all this?
Well, two things to say. First of all, you seem to know a disturbingly large amount about how to record people covertly. That's my first comment. Secondly, and look, this is a really fun story in a whole bunch of ways. I mean, he actually said, you know, being rich is my superpower, which is a really interesting thing to say.
Now, that you need on a T-shirt.
Yeah. And look, there are lots of things that came out. So in the reporting, one of the things that came out was the ways in which Anthony Pratt attempts to curry favour and exert political influence. He employs two former prime ministers on his payroll who are earning a substantial amount of money each month. Paul Keating, $25,000. But Tony Abbott, only $8,000.
Well, you know,
how would you feel if you're Tony Abbott?
Perhaps it's a recognition by Mr. Pratt of their value. But $300,000 a year to PJK, Paul Keating.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of clocks.
So I was really interested when I saw this story, just what it meant in terms of public interest, democracy, the way democracy works. And we had some discussions internally. Initially, we were a bit like, well, you know, former prime minister, you've been out of office a lot of years, you can be paid by somebody, there's no problem with it. Does it actually mean anything? But we found this academic called Ju Chong Pham from Melbourne Uni, who is an expert on questions about sort of political donations and the political process. And he actually made a really good point, which is what you end up dealing with here is what sort of what you call, there's no sort of what you call quid pro quo corruption, where you can say, you got this money and then you did this or you did that. But you can end up with this thing called clientism, which is the sort of corruption where you've got these relationships with people, and these people with whom you get the relationships get the ear of the political figures and they sort of get the outcome. So you've probably heard a lot about Qantas over recent, you know, months. And one of the things that's become a big controversy is all the politicians that are members of the Chairman's Lounge and the way that Qantas uses that, for example, to curry favour. And then you had the Qantas decision on, you know, Qatar and those airways. So, and it's sort of the same, it's the same thing. So, I mean, any former Prime Minister can earn money from anybody.
Of course.
And you know, Anthony Pratt, I guess, is entirely entitled to pay whoever he wants. But you do start to get this situation where people with a lot of wealth are creating a context where they've sort of got their fingers in everybody's pie, you know, and they've got influence over everybody.
Including King Charles. Well, that's actually right. When he was Prince Charles.
Giving King Charles money.
I mean,
did he really need it?
Like, you know, does he? Yeah. Like, and what did he expect? And he said, oh, you know, Rudy Giuliani wanting to pay him $1 million to come to his birthday party. I would have paid him $1 million to stay away.
Exactly.
But, like, it's disturbing because it actually, we wouldn't know about this if not for these tapes. But it's really, it disturbs me that, you know, Mr. Pratt is clearly not the only person who's doing this.
Absolutely.
No, it's a culture, and I think that's the problem. There is this culture of sort of patronage and favours and access, which, you know, unfortunately we know cuts out sort of ordinary people in a democracy and privileges a certain elite. And that's why you see, you know, rising cynicism about democracy more generally, I think.
And then, of course, you mentioned that there is the issue with Climate 200 because there is a dominant source of funding for the Teals, and that obviously comes from Simon Holmes-Corton and a number of others who contribute large amounts to the Teals.
That's right. So, I mean, it's not just one side of politics or the other. The idea is, generally speaking, if you have the political outcomes being driven by money from these particular sources, any particular power sources, it's a distortion on democracy and the democratic process.
Money talks in every language, doesn't it?
Money talks, it does. And it's a problem. So, look, it was a funny story, and it was, you know, brilliantly reported by The Age. And again, Nick McKenzie and the gang doing fantastic work. But it is worrying, I think, just to see those things working that way.
Now, we've actually got Josh has joined us on the phone.
No, Josh is outside. He's just on the phone.
Oh, he's on the phone outside. What, he's talking to someone other than us?
Outrageous.
How dare he? Baz, go out and give him a bit of shortbread. Do you think, Misha, that clearly, you know, if you're a current MP, you know, the requirements are you'd have to disclose that you were receiving money from someone for advice or as a consultant. So ex-PMs obviously and clearly don't have to disclose that. What price do you put on democracy?
Well, there is a...
$25,000 a month seems to be the starting point. Or, sorry, no, $8,000 a month for Tony Abbott.
There is a rule that if you've been a minister and you're going to be advising in the anything that relates to your former portfolio, there is a calling off period. I think it's a year or 2 years.
I think it's 18 months. Yeah, might be 18 months,
There's a period. So there's that formal thing. So both, you know, Tony Abbott and Paul Keating have been out of, you know, the prime ministership in formal roles for a long, long time. And the argument is, the counter argument is that you've got to, you know, you've got to earn a living. Politicians have to earn a living too, and they've got to get out in the world and do things.
Well, it's not like they're not getting a pension.
Well, that's true. I mean,
and an office.
Yeah, and Bob
and
Hawke,
a driver.
But if you look at
and staff.
You know, it's all sides of the pot. I mean, if you look at Bob Hawke, he did a lot of work in China later in his life. You know, people have to have an after politics career. But it just is the question about how much really money is sort of running things. And I think it just increases generally our scepticism and cynicism about the whole process.
Yes, well, for good reason, absolutely, because to a certain extent it's always been this way. We always know it's been this way, and that is that sense of will it ever change? I think that's part of the problem for a lot of ordinary people because they don't see that there's any way in.
That's right, you know, and interesting, the other thing I was thinking about, was going to talk about today was Michelle Grattan, our political commentator, is giving a lecture next week, which is called the Speaker's Lecture.
Where?
It's in Parliament House in the lecture theatre there. But it's basically what she's doing after 50 years in the press gallery of watching Australian politics is doing a bit of an audit of how things are working and talking about, you know, the way we see the political process. And
Michelle would know where all the bodies are buried, wouldn't she?
I think she does.
I reckon she's forgotten more, well, she may not have, but, you know, than any of us could remember. 50 years, you know, that goes back to the Whitlam era.
That's right. And, you know, she's basically doing this thing which I've really, you know, always been keen for her to do and I'm really glad that she's doing it. She's sort of casting her eye over where we're at now. And you're talking on the way here about sort of news avoidance and cynicism in the electorate. And she's basically saying, you know, that if you look across the political system, we've got a distrustful and disillusioned electorate, professionalised political system that alienates many of the people you'd want to attract into Parliament, a public service that's been found wanting, an excessively secretive approach to information and accountability, a media that's too often driven by clicks and ratings, social media that debases political discourse and increases partisanship. And I guess the question that she's looking at, which I think is a really interesting question, is our political system now fit for purpose? Can it deliver reform? Can it actually help us achieve the things that we want to achieve? And there's a lot of evidence that really it's very, very hard now for political parties, for politicians to actually do things and to achieve things and to achieve reform. Anyway, look, I mean, that speech will be given, I think it's Monday or Tuesday next week.
And will that be, is there a way that we can see it?
We'll publish it on The Conversation as well. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And Michelle, if you're using WhatsApp, be careful. A certain permanent secretary of department perhaps got some of his messages shared from WhatsApp. Don't know who shared them. And not naming anyone, but yeah, Michelle, if you're using WhatsApp, be really careful. So, you are on Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Josh Burns has joined us in the studio with Misha Ketchell. I'm Macca. Fiona's my co-host. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.